From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Bradley challenges Gore on racial profiling. As the primary season kicks off, a look at the issues important to people of color in Iowa and New Hampshire. And is General Pinochet really too sick to stand trial? We'll have an update from Spain, Britain, and Chile. And who makes the decisions around dietary guidelines for people in the United States? And what's their connection to various industries? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President-elect Ricardo Lagos says private enterprise shouldn't worry that a socialist has been chosen president for the first time since Salvador Allende was toppled in a bloody 1973 coup in Chile. Lagos emerged in the 1980s as a leading opponent of Pinochet, was briefly imprisoned for his activities, and repeated his promises now, quote, to work for the unity among Chileans, because he said the country often reflects the deep political divisions stemming from the Pinochet 1973 to 1990 dictatorship. This news from Florida. Two black lawmakers have staged a sit-in at the state capitol in Tallahassee to protest Florida Governor Jeb Bush's executive order repealing affirmative action for state contracts and university admissions. The sit-in began yesterday afternoon and continued into today in Florida Lieutenant Governor Frank Brogan's office. Florida State Senator Kendrick Meek of Miami and Congressmember Tony Hill of Jacksonville spent the night there with nine reporters who were told if they left, they wouldn't be allowed to return. A Florida law enforcement agent sat at Brogan's desk throughout the night. Jeb Bush announced the sit-in and vowed it would not change his position on affirmative action. Microsoft says it, quote, respectfully disagrees with the judge's ruling that the company is an abusive monopoly. In court papers filed yesterday, the company lawyers wrote, quote, having an extremely popular product does not make the company a monopolist. The Justice Department, meanwhile, says Microsoft's legal filing ignores the court's findings of fact and distorts key legal precedents. Even as Microsoft lawyers were arguing it is not the industry titan described by the government, the company announced its second quarter profits soared 22% to nearly $2.5 billion. Warner Lambert has held talks with Procter & Gamble to gauge interest in a possible three-way deal that would involve P&G buying both the drug maker and American Home Products. This according to the Wall Street Journal. Warner Lambert also makes certs and breath mints. American Home Product makes Advil, Anacin, and Preparation H. Among P&G's products are Tide laundry detergent, Tampax tampons, and Folgers coffee. Acquiring Warner Lambert, American Home, or both could make the consumer products company P&G a force in prescription drugs as well. The Supreme Court takes a new look at the free speech rights of anti-abortion demonstrators today. The case being argued involves a Colorado law that requires protesters to stay at least 8 feet away from people entering healthcare clinics unless someone agrees to closer contact to talk or take a leaflet. The Clinton administration in 18 states are backing Colorado. Justice Department lawyers say the law aims to ensure safe access to healthcare facilities. Suspected rightist militias killed at least seven unarmed villagers in northern Colombia, and officials fear dozens more are dead. Yesterday's killings followed bombings of electrical towers and bloody weekend clashes between government troops and guerrillas. Also yesterday, two hand grenades apparently thrown at a small police post in capital Bogota killed a girl and wounded five people at an adjacent school. An upsurge in Colombia's fighting had been expected following the expiration last week of a temporary year-end truce. Meanwhile, the Clinton administration is talking about giving more than $1.6 billion to Colombia to support the military, well known for its human rights abuses in Colombia. Nelson Mandela is bringing Burundi's civil war to the United Nations spotlight as part of a new effort to revive peace talks and end a conflict that has left more than 200,000 people dead and tens of thousands in dire humanitarian straits. Mandela is the featured speaker at an open meeting today of the Security Council, which is expected to adopt a resolution condemning a recent surge of violence in the small Central African nation that threatens to explode. Burundi's civil war has been raging for 6 years, but it's not received the international international attention of other conflicts, even those in Africa. Donor nations have provided only 17% of the more than $83 million requested last year by UN agencies to provide basic humanitarian aid to Burundians. This news from Argentina. The government yesterday restored the pension for the widow of the German industrialist featured in the film Schindler's List. Emily Schindler will receive $900 a month to help ease her economic plight, said the Interior Minister of Argentina. A change of government in December had disrupted the payment ordered last year by former President Carlos Menem. German industrialist Oskar Schindler is credited with saving nearly 1,300 Polish Jews from Nazi concentration camps by drawing up lists of fictitious jobs to convince German authorities they were essential to the war effort.
Well, I didn't get much sleep. Right. That's why I'm moving in a creep. Right. I've been walking so long. Right. I put blisters on the street. Right. Well, I caught the freedom fever. Right. And it settled in my feet. Right. Something said I better swim. Right. And I thought of Sheriff Jim. Right. When I thought of Sheriff Jim. Right. That's when I said I better swim. Right. I've been walking so long. Right. My feet done turned to wheels. Right. Hey, I got the freedom.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Juan, you still haven't gotten your son back, Elian.
No, but the controversy continues, and I'm sure there will be a resolution that I understand the grandmother now would like to come and claim the son, and it's a question of whether Janet Reno and the federal government will accept the grandmother over a great aunt as a claimant on Elian Gonzalez.
That's very interesting, because regular listeners to Democracy Now! May remember the Cuban-American attorney in Washington, Pertierra, who was saying repeatedly that he thought the best way to resolve this was to have both grandmothers come up to the United States, because Juan Miguel Gonzalez, not to be confused with Juan Gonzalez right here, it would just be better, since this is all about PR anyway, that this doesn't have to do with basic laws, because with the INS, the boy would have been sent right back, that they should just come up to get him. But right now, we're going to talk about another issue that actually has taken center stage with presidential candidates. Yes, by the way, Gore has spoken out on the issue, as have Republican candidates as well. He said he wanted the boy to remain here for a while, clearly concerned about his support in the right-wing Cuban-American community in Florida, from which he's getting more than $300,000. But this past Monday in Iowa, Democratic presidential contenders Al Gore and Bill Bradley faced off in their last debate between the Iowa caucus, as well as the New Hampshire primary, the last one that will be held. The event was sponsored by the Iowa Brown Black Presidential Forum, hoping to raise questions about the administration's commitment to people of color. Bradley challenged the vice president to press Clinton to issue an executive order banning racial profiling. Gore fired back with a forceful defense of the president, saying that he has not only talked the talk, but walked the walk, whereupon he got roundly booed, but it may have been because there were a lot of Bradley supporters in the audience. And there also may have been a lot of questions about what Clinton's actual record on African Americans has been. Meanwhile, in New Hampshire this week, people celebrated Martin Luther King's birthday as an official state holiday for the first time, after a campaign led by African-American community and groups such as the American Friends Service Committee, state lawmakers recognized the King holiday last summer. I guess they got tired of the Klan coming to New Hampshire to march on the state capitol every Martin Luther King's birthday to thank them for not celebrating Martin Luther King's birthday as a state holiday or a federal holiday. People of color are in very small numbers in Iowa and New Hampshire. When the presidential candidates leave these states, they move on to the southern primaries, where African Americans play a decisive role. And at this point, Gore seems to have a substantial lead among African Americans in states like Florida, Georgia, and Texas. Those states, along with New York and California, all cast their votes in the first half of March. We're joined on the phone right now by two people. We're joined by New Hampshire State Representative Lionel Johnson, instrumental in the movement to bring the King holiday to New Hampshire, and Iowa State Representative Wayne Ford, who's founder of the Iowa Brown Black Presidential Forum, which was the sponsor of the Democrat contenders' last debate Monday night in Des Moines, Iowa. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much, and good morning to the representative from Iowa.
Representative Johnson, we'd like to begin with you. First of all, why did it take New Hampshire so long to declare Martin Luther King's birthday a holiday?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. As being a legislator, one of the things that I have seen and tried to work with that, as you know, who makes the laws, it would be the people in the legislature. And we have a very heavily popular legislature. We have 400 people in the House of Representatives. And it has been quite tough to get the consensus of those 400 people to say, yes, we wanted Dr. King's name on the holiday. And I guess, as everyone knows, in the country, the things had been said about Dr. King as being a communist, he's against the Vietnam War, and his name would be the oldest person named that is on a holiday, and there are other people, such as Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, and other people, name is not directly on a holiday. So that was one of the difficult things that we had to try to overcome.
And in view of the fact that New Hampshire and Iowa play such pivotal roles in the early periods of presidential primaries, does it bother you at all that how few African Americans or Latinos are in either of those states, so that the issues that most affect those communities rarely get discussed?
Well, then again, you're going back to politics of what really happened. New Hampshire got to be placed. Iowa have the caucus. Just recently, the last couple of days, you've heard more of our, you would say, minorities got involved, or minorities was mentioned in the different arguments or discussion that they had. And I think as time go by, with the holiday here, I think in New Hampshire, we will have more minorities who would look at New Hampshire and say, this is a place that I would like to live. Before, people was going to different, going away instead of coming towards New Hampshire.
We are also joined on the phone by the founder of the Iowa Brown Black Presidential Forum, State Representative Wayne Ford. What was that debate like on Monday night, and what about the issue of racial profiling?
And, thank you a lot for being on this show, and I'm very excited to give you an opportunity to hear about the people of Iowa. The first thing I wanted to say before I go into the show about what happened was is that the first two babies born in the state of Iowa in the year 2000 were Hispanic and black. In 1900, there were two white babies. The bottom line is, as we go off into the new millennium, the color of America is changing. And so I just want to put that out there so people who listen to this show can recognize that the color of Iowa and New Hampshire are changing. The racial profiling issue drew a heated discussion. Iowa should feel like it should be involved with racial profiling since we're the number one state in the country for the incarceration of black men. Governor Vilsack has appointed me to co-chair a group of people to make sure and find out why I was leading the nation, putting black men in jail. So we have some deep issues that we have to deal here in the state of Iowa. When people ask the question regarding how is Iowa the right state, we only got a few minorities, I want to put those issues out there. Number one, in incarceration of minority men, and also the first babies born in the new millennium are minorities. The issue of racial profiling, we thought both candidates answered well. But I thought Gore took a slight lead when he said that once he's elected, then he will make an executive order, and that will be his first sense of business. So if I look for any the distinction between racial profiling and what the two candidates said, Gore gave us a timetable. Bill Bradley did not.
Although Gore answered that question in response to Bradley saying, right, would you issue an executive order if you were president that banned racial profiling?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand.
Gore answered Bradley's challenge of whether he would issue an executive order. Is that right?
Right. Well, when he said it would be his first order of business, then that was the thing that I thought that many people, when I left, kind of came to me and said, well, That's part of public record. We have problems here in Iowa, and we will hold him accountable. So these both men are very similar on issues regarding race, but there was a distinction between an executive order and a situation that had no timetable.
The George Bush on the Republican side, there's been a lot of coverage about how he's expected to make or is planning to make huge inroads into the Latino vote across the country. What's your sense of how Hispanics in Iowa, of which there are a growing number, especially in the beef, working in the beef industry there, how they are responding to George Bush versus the Democratic candidates?
Well, we have some labels in Iowa that are receiving national attention. We have a community in Marshalltown, Iowa, which Geraldo Rivera was on about 3 weeks ago. This community in Iowa is named the number one drug capital of the world when it comes to meth, you know. And so we are getting national attention regarding, you know, Hispanics. Many communities are saying, we don't want immigrants coming into our community. You're changing the colors of Iowa. So we were very surprised that, you know, Governor Bush has not made an Hispanic an issue in Iowa the way he has had made in Texas. He has promised the state of Iowa that he would do commercials in Hispanic. That has not happened yet. And he has promised me and many other leaders that he would be involved with a presidential debate on race for the Republican Party. That has never happened. So to be candid with you, I believe that Hispanics and blacks here in Iowa, this is not Texas, is seeing George Bush for what he's worth. He's a good talker, but he's not putting issues up here in the state of Iowa when it comes to minorities.
State Representative Wayne Ford of Iowa, have you made a decision on who you'll be supporting?
No, I'm making my decision a little bit later today, and I feel as though that you would know about it because it plans to be a national press conference here in the city of Des Moines, and my statement should be well known in about a couple hours.
What percentage of people are Latino, Black, Native American in Iowa?
Okay, we have about 70,000 Hispanics, Latinos, about 50,000 Blacks and other minorities. So altogether, I would say roughly 150,000 minorities for the population of Iowa.
Mm-hmm. And New Hampshire State Representative Lionel Johnson in New Hampshire, the percentages?
Well, the percentage here would be, well, we have 1.7 million and overall. And Iowa, here in New Hampshire, we have less than 1%.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to the representative from Iowa, I wish we had that amount here. Perhaps we could do it a little better. And speaking of George Bush, I mean, here he's running commercials like about every 20 minutes on some of our major station, television station, radio station. But he's not talking race. He's talking about the monies that the administration have done over the 7 years, that you have a balanced budget, not a balanced budget, but you have a surplus. And he is telling the people here in New Hampshire on how he could use that surplus, that he will not spend it, he would not leave it in Washington, he would give it back to the people in New Hampshire. And he's telling the people in New Hampshire just how much money that he would save in cutting the taxes. But when we listen to Iowa, he doesn't mention anything concerning race. You have a couple of commercials that say what he have done for different Hispanics in Texas on how he cut the taxes, that different thing. But when it comes to New Hampshire, he only you're asking for your vote and what he would do for you, but when it comes to race, he's not using that here.
What do you feel are the most important issues in New Hampshire?
Well, the most important issues are in New Hampshire right now would be talking more about the race. I mean, we just had the celebrations of Martin Luther King for the first time in the past 20 years. So I feel if we talk more about balancing the races, that we would have more people. We have a lot of Hispanics that are coming into, especially into Manchester. And Latinos, this is one of the heavily populated areas right now in Manchester. And when those things happen, with our schools, we have to redo our schools and places to live and so on, because we were not prepared for the influx of minority that we have coming into New Hampshire. So I think we're going to have to take another look at what is going on. And I heard you ask the question about who are you supporting. I am very proud to say that I'm supporting Gore because I think this administration have done to a degree that other administrations have never done, is appointing more minorities to different higher jobs and so on in the country. So I think the minorities, no matter where you are, if you would take a look at this administration of what they have done, in helping minorities is one of the things that I think we should be looking forward to. And I'm very proud to say that I will support them, and I'm for them 100% because I think they have done more in the past 7 years towards helping minorities, giving them jobs, and putting them in higher places than it ever been in, I would say, in quite a few years in this country.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. We didn't ask you, Mr. Johnson, if you've come out endorsing someone.
Well, I'm endorsing Mr.
Gore. Oh, sorry. I just missed
President
that. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to make sure, Mr. Johnson, I thank you for the good work that you've done in the state of New Hampshire.
Well, thank you very much. And, you know, it's quite a pleasure. We can't see each other from from the distance, but I was just happy to be on the same line with you. And good luck to you out there, and I hope we will meet somewhere along the line.
I'm sure we will.
Continue this
and thank
kind of a dialogue.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Okay. Iowa State Representative Wayne Ford and New Hampshire State Representative Lionel Johnson. When we return, we're going to England and to Spain and hopefully to Chile. And we're going to talk about these last minute maneuverings around whether Augusta Pinochet will remain in England, will be sent to Spain, or be sent back to Chile. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Well, a Chilean plane is flying to Britain today in anticipation of the possible, some say imminent, release of former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet from house arrest, where he's remained since October of 1998. British officials will announce a final decision any time on whether the 84-year-old general should be released or extradited to Spain to face charges of torture. British Home Secretary Jack Straw is wading through volumes of paperwork that lawyers in Spain, France, and Belgium, as well as human rights groups, have submitted in response to Straw's preliminary decision last week that Pinochet is medically unfit to stand trial. Straw made that announcement after reviewing the results of a medical exam conducted by a team of doctors. Human rights groups have criticized the British government's decision not to allow the parties seeking his extradition to review the results of the medical exam. Yesterday, several doctors delivered a letter to the British government saying Pinochet's medical exam had not been thorough enough to determine whether he's fit to stand trial. Further controversy erupted this week when the lead doctor of the medical team that examined Pinochet refuted Straw's claim to the House of Commons that the doctors had reported Pinochet to be unfit to stand trial. The doctor, Sir John Grimley Evans, told the newspaper, The Observer, that the decision about whether Pinochet was fit for trial was, quote, outside our field of competence and outside our responsibilities. We're going to Britain, to Spain, and to Chile in this segment. We'll start with Jeremy Corbyn, who is a Labour MP, who is asking Jack Straw to release the medical information on Pinochet. He's led a delegation asking the Metropolitan Police of London to arrest Pinochet on torture charges as well. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremy Corbyn.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Well, tell us the latest.
Well, the latest is that 5 p.m. yesterday, our time, the Home Secretary set the deadline for all the submissions we've got to make, and we presented a very large number yesterday morning on behalf of human rights groups and the Chilean exile community, and there was a big march down to the Home Office to hand them all in and a 17,000 signature petition. And the Home Secretary said he's going to examine them all and make an announcement, which might not even be until next week, on what he thinks about it. In the meantime, there's a number of other things going on. One is the Spanish government are considering judicial review of Jack Straw, the Home Secretary's decision, which would have the effect of releasing the medical information. And also, I have taken a delegation, as you just described, to the Metropolitan Police to ask them to be prepared to arrest Pinochet in the event of the extradition proceedings collapsing under British law, because the International Convention Against Torture applies in British law as well. And so if the extradition case collapses, then we believe Pinochet would be liable to arrest here.
And what's been the public reaction to to John Grimley Evans's contradiction of the Home Secretary?
Quite big, and I raised it in the House of Commons on Monday. I've got in front of me his letter to the Home Office that he wrote afterwards, which is trying to clarify the situation. My understanding of it all is that Dr. Grimley Evans was part of the examining team, and it seems that they did not specifically say Pinochet wasn't fit to stand trial. They described his medical condition. There are two issues to be discussed here with the Home Office. One is that there wasn't a psychiatrist as part of the examination, and part of the claim is that Pinochet is mentally not fit to comprehend the trial and follow it and all that is necessary for that. And secondly, that only two of the doctors spoke Spanish and indeed undertook to translate for the other two, which doesn't seem to me to be a very satisfactory way of going about things. We're talking here of the basic problem is the decision Jack Straw took to allow Pinochet's medical examination to go on the basis that the only people that would have the results would be Jack Straw and Pinochet and Pinochet's lawyers. We think that any decision as to whether or not a court case goes ahead should be made in open court and not in private.
Jeremy Corbyn, that's pretty astounding. You've got these doctors evaluating his mental abilities and they can't even speak his language. What did they say? He seemed to be speaking a foreign language that no one could understand.
Well, unfortunately, I wasn't there when they did it, so I'm not entirely sure about this.
Well,
but it seems to me just not right that somebody who's indicted on major crimes, such as the International Convention Against Terrorism, should in effect now have a power of veto on whether or not the process goes ahead.
What about what's been happening behind the scenes? How did this happen? What were the negotiations that most people do not know about that took place between the Chilean government and the British government around sending Pinochet back to Chile?
The background to it all goes way back to 1998, when Pinochet arrived in Britain on a mission to buy arms. He also was having some minor surgery. When he was arrested on the extradition request from Spain, he immediately claimed diplomatic immunity. That was tested in the courts and eventually was rejected on the grounds that he did not have diplomatic immunity. He was not a diplomat. He then tried something called head of state immunity, and that was also tested in the courts and again eventually rejected after lengthy hearings. And so he had no immunity in that respect. The Chilean government have always been of the view that Pinochet should go back to Chile and claimed that he should face justice in Chile, conveniently not telling the world that the Chilean constitution specifically gave Pinochet immunity from prosecution. Over the past couple of months, they've been running this story that he's medically unfit to stand trial. Indeed, Mrs. Thatcher has been saying so as well. Yet we find that only a month ago he managed to send out personally 300 Christmas cards, that he's written letters to people, he's given interviews, he's made press statements, and now he's claiming that he's medically unfit. Frankly, many people are sceptical about this and doubt it, and we, at the very least, want the case to go back into court so it can be a legal decision. Otherwise, if he goes back to Chile, unless there's going to be a suspension of his legal immunity, which is very unlikely given that the Supreme Court was in part appointed by Pinochet in the first place.
Now, what about in his house, the conditions of his house arrest? Does he receive visitors or can he only just see his lawyers? What are those conditions?
Lax conditions. He has a very expensive house set in countryside just outside London next to Windsor Great Park. It's a very expensive house and it costs several thousand pounds a week, I think £10,000 a week, so like $15,000 a week in rent. It's a lot of money. He pays for that himself. He can receive visitors. He can only go into the garden with the permission of the police who are on duty all the time and guarding the place. But he does receive visitors. He does have access to phone calls, does have access to computers, email, and all the rest of it, and appears to have no problem in communicating with the rest of the world. What he cannot do is leave the property.
We're on the line with British parliamentarian Jeremy Corbyn. He's a Labour MP in Britain, led a delegation asking the Metropolitan Police of London to arrest Pinochet on torture charges. And we're going to get to that point in a minute. But we're also joined by Fabiola Letelier, who is the sister of Orlando Letelier, former defense minister for Salvador Allende, who is Orlando Letelier, assassinated in 1976 in Washington, D.C. by a car bomb, along with Ronnie Moffat, traced back to Pinochet's secret police, the DINA. Fabiola Letelier is a human rights attorney in Santiago. Can you give us the latest from there, the reaction to the plane being sent from Chile now to Britain with a probability that Pinochet will be coming back to Chile, Fabiola Letelier?
You know, the announcement of the Minister of Interior, Mr. Jack Straw, was received in Chile when the Chilean people was in the middle of the election of the new president of the republic. So it was really a very important issue, but it was impossible in the moment that we received this news to take care of it. But now that the election was made, was given the presidency to Ricardo Lagos, now the people of Chile is coming to be more concerned with this decision of or this announcement of Straw, and of course the Chilean human rights organization, and especially the relatives of the victim. We are, of course, trying to write to present petition before the Britannic authorities, in which we precise that in our concept, the announcement of Mr. Straw is violating several international instruments. First of all, the Convention on European Extradition, that in their norms does not include the humanitarian reasons. And of course, is violating the convention, the International Convention on Torture, that because in one of his articles is expressed that the state that are working with the petition of extradition, they have to give themselves all the cooperation that is necessary in the procedures that are going on. In third part, there is a convention of Vienna of 1969 that is related to the treaties and the law, and it says clearly in one of the articles of this convention that has been approved by England and, of course, Spain, that it says that never a norm of the interior legislation can be prevailed about an international rule. So for us, there are many arguments in the law that are giving for that Mr. Straw review the position that he has assumed.
Well,
and
Fabiola,
finally, I would like to tell you that yesterday morning, before the 11th, because that was the deadline for present justification before the Minister of Straw, a group of relatives of the victims, that we are all of them part of the process in Spain, we went to the British Embassy to make a petition to Mr. Straw, saying all these arguments, not only under the international law, but also adding that for us, the victims, this is a new damage that are giving us, because Mr. Straw, if he, in his final decision, accept the liberation of Pinochet and the return to Chile, all the victims, that are thousands of thousands, we are going to the denegation of justice for ourselves.
Well, Fabiola Letelier, what about the new government now? Do you expect any change in the policy of the Chilean government over this Pinochet issue now that Ricardo Lagos has been elected president?
Presidente Lagos, in the speech that he made before that more than 60,000 people said, when the people that was in that square started to scream, saying, "Juicio a Pinochet, judgment to Pinochet," Presidente Lagos said that this is a matter of the tribunals in Chile. That was the argument that he made. But I would like to add that it is very complex for the Chilean people to obtain justice in a trial of Pinochet before our tribunals. First of all, because Pinochet is a senator for life, so before that he face a tribunal, he must to be before the Court of Appeal in Chile, a court that has to decide that he can be submitted to a process. So they have to pronounce about the parliamentarian immunity that covers Pinochet now. So after that, he will be able to face a tribunal, a minister in Chile, Juan Guzmán, that's, as you know, he is investigating more than 52 petitions against Pinochet. So it is very complex for us.
Fabiola Letelier, sister of Orlando Letelier and a human rights attorney, speaking to us from Santiago, Chile. Jeremy Corbyn, Labour MP, speaking to us from Britain. On this issue, Jeremy Corbyn, of the Metropolitan Police of London arresting Pinochet on torture charges, what exactly would this mean? So you'd have it ruled that he would be sent back to Chile, most likely, Straw will rule this, and then the police would pick him up again?
No. Jack Straw says that the extradition isn't going ahead and then subject to any legal challenge, and that is quite a strong possibility, then there would be a further legal proceedings in Britain on the medical issue. In the event of the entire process of extradition not going ahead, then we believe that he could and should be arrested under British law. That's a matter for the police to decide whether or not they're going to do that. We went to see the Home Office, on Monday morning, with all the necessary evidence concerning torture of individuals, both in the physical sense that they were tortured during Pinochet's regime, but also the continuing torture where their relatives are missing because the body has never been discovered. And in those cases, that is, in international law, that is continuing torture. And so we believe that Pinochet is liable on two counts there. One is the actual torture, and the other one is the continuing torture.
But given the apparent unwillingness of the British government to actually have to confront this issue, do you expect the Metropolitan Police to act independently of the national government?
They have a duty to follow the law that has been laid down for them to follow. The Criminal Justice Act quite specifically includes the International Convention Against Torture. I made a formal reference to them in September of last year to ask them to prepare arrest documents. The meeting on Monday morning confirmed that they have an active file on Pinochet's case, confirmed that they have a great deal of evidence, confirmed they have access to the Spanish evidence that Balthazar Garzon has put together in his application for extradition, and also we offered any further information from specific exiles in this country who have suffered and continue to suffer torture. There is, in my view, a duty on the Metropolitan Police to act in this way. Now, I am not the police. They will have to make their decision on this, but we're putting all the pressure we can on to ensure that justice goes ahead.
Final question to Fabiola Letelier in Santiago, Chile, and we just have 30 seconds. This is opening up a massive discussion in Chile about the crimes against humanity that took place during the Pinochet years. Here we've talked about it, but I understand in Chile it is new. What's happening to people who were traumatized then, who were survivors or had loved ones killed?
No, in this moment in Chile, there are many, many different groups that are organizing themselves to act if Pinochet is returned to Chile. I really believe that we are going to organize a very huge public manifestation. And of course, the lawyers, the group of lawyers of human rights that are acting before the Minister Juan Guzmán, they are ready to make all the decisions before the tribunal. We are not going to be passive. We are going to ask and demand for justice as well as we have done for 25 years, the last 25 years, especially during the military dictatorship.
Well, Fabiola Letelier,
I'm very conscious that if Minister Restore stops the procedure in Spain, we are going to lose the only opportunity to obtain a real and just process that is in Spain, not in Chile. And, of course, this decision of Minister Restore could end a process that have been in the middle of the consciousness of all around the world
Fabiola Letelier, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We're sorry we have to end this segment. Speaking to us from Santiago, Chile, a human rights attorney, and Jeremy Corbyn, Labour MP from Britain. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, looking at a piece in The Guardian. It says that General Pinochet is as likely to go to trial in Chile as he is to go to heaven. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, a panel that will provide dietary guidelines for the Food and Drug Administration has been accused of racism and conflict of interest by a group that says the panel members receive financial support from the food industry, from the very sectors of the food industry that they are supposedly making recommendations about. The organization, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, is filing an injunction today against the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee because it says many of its members are financed by the dairy, egg, and meat industry, as well as drug companies. The organization also accuses the committee of racial bias in deciding its guidelines because it heavily recommends dairy products as a calcium source, even though many African Americans, Latinos, and Asians are lactose intolerant. The guidelines are significant because they embody the official diet policies of the U.S. government, dictating what is served in school lunches and food assistance programs. We're joined right now by Mindy Kurzban. She is the staff attorney for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Why don't you lay out the issue for us, Mindy?
Well, the United States Department of Agriculture and Department of Health and Human Services jointly appointed a Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee to make recommendations for revision to the year 2000 edition of the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. The Dietary Guidelines are supposed to be revised every 5 years based on the most current scientific evidence. The committee that was selected by the USDA and HHS is by law to be free of any inappropriate conflicts of interest and is also supposed to be fairly balanced in terms of the points of view of the members and the function to be performed by the committee. More than half of this year's committee members have inappropriate ties to the meat, dairy, and egg industries. There's nobody on the committee who represents the interests of those people who are directly affected by the dietary guidelines, which would include federal food assistance recipients, because the federal food programs, the nutritional standards therein, rely on the dietary guidelines. The committee will continue to recommend that every American eat a daily diet that consists of 2 to 3 servings each of meat and dairy products, and therefore failing to acknowledge the chronic disease disparities and food tolerability differences between Caucasians and people of color. And we have filed a suit under the Federal Advisory Committee Act because of the violations in regard to the balance and the conflicts of interest. And we are filing a motion for a temporary restraining order today requesting the court to prevent the committee from releasing its report until there's been a final determination on the merits of our lawsuit.
I'd like to go more slowly through the conflicts of interest represented on this board. Can you give us some examples?
Sure. To start off, the chairman of the committee, all of the committee members, their primary employment is with a university. Then they have these other relationships outside of that employment. And the chairman is a scientific advisor to the Dannon Institute, which is funded by the Dannon Yogurt Company. He has also been an advisor to the National Dairy Council. And the Dairy Council, as you would imagine, promotes dairy products for American farmers.
It's an industry group?
It's an industry group, right. He also organized a nutrition research symposium that was funded by Mead Johnson. Mead Johnson sells primarily dairy-based products. One of the major products that they do have is an infant formula. And Mead Johnson participates in the infant rebate system of the Women and Children Supplemental Feeding Program, which is commonly known as WIC. And under that program, which is subject to the dietary guidelines, Mead Johnson in 1998 was the largest provider of infant formula under the WIC program.
So, in other words, Cuthberto Garza, who is the chair, is on the payroll as well of Mead Johnson, which is one of the beneficiaries of a dietary guideline program that would advocate dairy.
Right, and he's not on their payroll. He received money from them to sponsor a symposium that was put on by his department at the university, where he is a professor in the nutritional department. He received funding by Mead Johnson in order to have a symposium. And while that money isn't obviously going directly, it's not that he's an employee, it gives the appearance of conflict that he is, on one hand, accepting money from them, whether it goes into his pocket or promotes his personal, his personal professional interest. And then, on the other hand, he is setting nutritional standards that will affect programs under which this organization, the company, has a significant monetary interest in.
I also see that Dr. Garza organized a symposium in conjunction with, sponsored by, funded by Nestle Corporation, which produces dairy-based infant formulas, as we well know from Africa and other developing countries.
Yes, and there's a concern also because of, which you may be aware of, the whole issue of breastfeeding. And there are a number of physicians who strongly oppose the giving infant formula to these developing countries, because then the mothers don't breastfeed their children, and there's also some other issues in regard to that. And so, you know, Dr. Garza is working with two huge providers of infant formula in developing countries.
So he's the chair. Let's go right down the list. What about Richard Deckelbaum?
Dr. Deckelbaum was also, well, he was a lecturer by the Nestle Research Center, invited lecturer, and they are, of course, funded by the Nestle company. He has received research donations from Mead Johnson and most recently received a $500,000 grant from Mead Johnson. He has received grant support from the what's now called the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, which is another trade association representing beef producers, meat packers, and food retailers. He served as chairman on the board of trustees for the SlimFast Nutrition Institute, which most of us are familiar with, the SlimFast dairy-based products to help people lose weight. Those are all dairy-based again. That's primarily his involvement. Actually, also for 3 years, 1989 to 1992, he received grant funding, again, from the National Promotion and Research Board. This is the board that's funded by milk producers, and most people are very familiar with those milk mustache ads. That's the board that's in charge of that campaign to encourage all Americans to drink milk.
Moving from milk to eggs, let's talk a little about Scott Grundy, another member of the board of that is the advisory committee for making dietary guidelines.
Yes, Dr. Grundy has served on the American Egg Grant Review Board since 1973. Again, it's another sort of trade association funded by egg producers, which seeks to increase the market for eggs and various egg products. And we also have Dr. Joanna Dwyer. She, for 3 years, from 1990 to 1993, served on the Grant Review Committee for the American Meat Institute, which is another trade association representing pork, beef, lamb, veal, and turkey producers. She served as a member of the scientific advisory group for the same board as Dr. Deckelbaum, this Dairy Promotion and Research Board. And she also had a visiting professorship. She participated in a visiting professorship program from 1990 to 1995 that was sponsored by the National Dairy Council. Dr. Rachel Johnson, I'll keep going. There's a few more. Dr. Rachel Johnson, she received fellowships from Kraft General Foods, which is a huge food manufacturer, and they also have a large amount of dairy-based products. She, in 1996, gave a presentation upon invitation of the National Dairy Council, and she also received a $42,000 grant in 1996-1997, which, by the way, was the year she would have been selected to serve on this committee. She received that grant from Dairy Management Incorporated, which is sort of like the parent organization of the National Dairy Council, in order to study the effect of milk on school children. Dr. Roland Weinseer recently received a $500,000 grant from Mead Johnson, similar to the one that Dr. Deckelbaum received. And although Dr. Eileen Kennedy is not a member of this advisory committee, even worse, she is an employee of the USDA. She's a deputy undersecretary of agriculture with the agency that's overseeing the part of the Department of Agriculture that's overseeing the dietary guidelines review process. She serves as a scientific advisor to the Danon Research Institute. So of the 11 members, six of them have conflicts, and then there's an additional conflict by an employee of the USDA who also receives other money from the Danon Yogurt Company.
We're talking with Mindy Kurzban, who is the staff attorney with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, exposing the, to say the least, extensive conflicts of interest on the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, which really determines the food that many people in this country eat. As you were saying, while many people just look to the dietary guidelines as a sort of objective standard for making sure you get some cheese, some dairy, some etc. When it comes to schools and federal programs, that determines what's bought. So this is big business.
It's huge business, obviously, in for the food industry, and it's also big business in the government's actions in regard to how they treat the food industries. I think most people are also aware of the extensive subsidies that the government provides to the meat, dairy, and egg industries, and then they buy these surplus products that are left on the market that people aren't purchasing, and then they dump them on our school children because they don't have anywhere else to go. They have to do something with these products. And then they pick an advisory committee who they know is going to set nutritional standards for the school lunch program and picks people to sit on that committee who are from the meat, dairy, and egg industries.
So explain exactly what your injunction, your call for an injunction, would accomplish.
What we're trying to do under the Federal Advisory Committee Act is to have the courts address this issue of the inappropriate conflicts of interest. And also, we've requested the court to appoint a member on the committee who can represent the interests of those people who are affected most directly by the dietary guidelines, which, as we've mentioned, is the federal food assistance recipients. There's nobody on the committee representing what is in their best interest, yet there are six people on the committee representing the interests of the food industry. So the temporary restraining order would request that the committee not be able to issue its report until these matters under the Federal Advisory Committee Act have been resolved, so that the court can make a determination on whether the Federal Advisory Committee Act was violated, and if so, rectify the situation as it stands now, which would be we would request to reconstitute the committee. If the report is released, then that remedy will not be available, because once the report is released, it will be given to the government agencies responsible for for putting out the new edition of the guidelines. And this could all take place before the merits of the lawsuit are even heard. So we're basically asking the court to maintain the status quo.
Would you say that this Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee has more members with more conflicts of interest than ever before?
I really don't have enough information to answer that. We have requested information on past committees. They began in 1985 with very little fanfare. There was no concern at that time. But it has grown as people have become more aware of what the government is doing and more interested in holding the government accountable for what it does, kind of looking behind what is actually there and questioning why is this happening, who's making these decisions. We haven't received full information on the previous committees in order to give you an answer to that.
Well, Mindy Kurzban, I want to thank you very much for being with us again, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, based in Washington, D.C. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And that website, again, is www.pcrm.org. That's Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. PCRM.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland's our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!